Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight, as part of the Institute for Philosophy and Religion series, The Stranger's Religion, Fascination and Fear, Wendy Doniger, Distinguished Service Professor of Religions at the University of Chicago, speaks of other people's myths, with special reference to the ancient Sanskrit texts that form the foundation of the Hindu religion. Professor Doniger.
The modern comparative study of religion was in large part designed in the pious hope of teaching our own people that alien religions were like ours in many ways. The hope was that if we learned about other religions, we would no longer hate and kill their followers, that to know them is to love them. Emmanuel Levinas argued that the face of the other says, "Don't kill me." This is the face that the comparative enterprise strives to illuminate. I wrote this several weeks ago. A glance at any newspaper should tell us that this goal has yet to be fulfilled in the world at large. Little did I know. But the academic world, having gone beyond this simplistic paradigm, now suffers from a kind of post-postcolonial backlash. In this age of multinationalism and the politics of individual ethnic and religious groups, of identity politics and minority politics, to assume that two phenomena from different cultures are the same in any significant way is regarded as demeaning to the individualism of each, a reflection of the old racist attitude that all WOGs look alike. In our day, too, and at the other end of the anti-colonial continuum, seeing correspondences between cultures has come to be regarded as politically retrograde for different reasons. As Annie Dillard discovered in China in 1983, quote, "Mao said that there's no such thing as human nature, there's only class nature. To talk about human nature is then to undermine the theoretical basis of socialism, that people, despite differences in culture, have feelings in common," was, as recently as 4 months ago, a somewhat risky statement in China, end quote. 1983. It's still risky in America and many politically sensitized academic cultures. Moreover, in the present climate of anti-Orientalism, it is regarded as imperialist of a scholar who studies India, for instance, to stand outside, presumably above, phenomena from different cultures and to equate them. The present trend is to study only one cultural group, Jews, African Americans, or only one gender, and indeed to study one's own cultural group or gender. This is a trend fueled in large part by the high moral ground assumed by disciplines such as feminism and cultural studies that argue or imply that their subject matter, racism, sexism, the class struggle, genocide, has such devastating human consequences that there is no room for more than one answer. And there goes interdisciplinary studies. And that, moreover, the experience, more particularly the sufferings of injustice of the particular group, are unique and therefore not comprehensible to anyone who has not, comme on dit, been there. There goes comparative studies, indeed, area studies in general, taking non-Western civ with it on the way down. I would challenge this trend of limiting those who study a group to those who within the group, women studying women, Jews studying Jews, a trend which, if followed slavishly, would automatically eliminate not only my own tiny, precious world of cross-cultural comparison, but the more general humanism of which it is an essential part. In my own case, this sort of identity politics has led to a very nasty attack on a number of leading scholars of Hinduism and on my students and on myself, by a right-wing Hindu who is not a scholar, but simply a businessman with the leisure and capital to flood the internet with his invectives, whose argument is that I have no right to tell anyone my ideas about Hinduism because I am not a Hindu, that I should stop writing and listen to him because he is a Hindu. To complicate the matter, he's also attacked the standing president of the American Academy of Religion, who is a Hindu, because she uses Western ideas in her own scholarship. So Freud and Marx turn out to be the enemy, even more threatening when they are in the head of a Hindu, but still unacceptable in the mind of a non-scholar, a non-Hindu scholar of Hinduism. This is the bigoted version of a more thoughtful academic program that Wilfred Cantwell Smith, half a century ago, introduced at Harvard, a tradition that I used to mock as, David Eccles hates me to say this, as the take a Buddhist to dinner school of thought, which reigned for many years at the Center for the Prevention of World Religions, as it was known in certain circles when I was there in the 50s and early 60s. The other extreme was represented by the Chicago school that I later joined, which argued that the last person in the world you would want to ask about Buddhism is a Buddhist. Not merely because of a possible emotional bias, but simply because there are so many different sorts of Buddhists, so that no one Buddhist could have the wide-angle lens that a properly educated scholar of Buddhism should have. Neither of these extremes now dominates either of these two institutions, though both tendencies are more broadly influential than I would want them to be. I want to argue for a kind of parallax, a double fix on the distant universe that would combine the view of the insider, which we can find both from texts and from living informants, and the approach of the outsider, ourselves and our colleagues, living and dead. In terms of academic theory, the emphasis on individual cultures tends to generate a smaller and smaller focus until it is impossible to generalize even from one moment to the next. Nothing has enough in common with anything else to be compared with it, even for the purpose of illuminating its distinctiveness. Each event is unique, like William James's crab, who insisted that he was not just a crustacean but himself alone. The radical particularizing of much recent theory in cultural anthropology, for instance, seems to deny any shared base even to members of the same culture, much less to humanity as a whole. If we start with the assumption of absolute difference and the belief that each culture can only be understood from the inside by the insider, that no one can study anyone else, there can be no conversation. And we find ourselves trapped in the self-reflexive garden of a looking glass ghetto, forever meeting ourselves, walking back in through the cultural door from which we were trying to escape. Identity politics may lead to a form of paralyzing reductionism and demeaning essentialism, and thence into an area where difference itself can be politically harmful. For where extreme universalism means that the other is exactly like you, a distortion that must indeed be avoided, and that people like Talal Asad have taught us to avoid, extreme nominalism means that the other may not be human at all. In fact, I'll leave that aside. Many of the people who argued and continue to argue that Jews or blacks or any other group defined as WOGs were all alike, that is, like one another, went on to argue or more often to assume that they were all different, that is, different from us white people, us Protestants. And this latter argument easily led to the assertion that such people did not deserve certain human rights like the rest of us. Essentialized difference can become an instrument of dominance. European colonialism was supported by a discourse of difference. Indeed, the members of a single cultural group may be very different, and it is just as insulting to say that all Japanese are alike as to say that the Japanese are just like the French. The essentialism of time can be just as harmful as the essentialism of place. We cannot explain Shakespeare simply by understanding the Elizabethan age. The culturally essentialized position is in itself both indefensible and politically dangerous. Yet it is often assumed in culturally contextualized and historically specific studies. Let me tell you how everyone felt at the fin de siècle in Europe and America. The focus on the class or ethnic group, if monolithic, can become not only boring but racist. My aim instead is an expansive, humanistic outlook on inquiry that enhances our humanity in both its particularity and its commonality. The argument for understanding any phenomenon only in terms of its cultural context when followed to the end of its line is like Thomas Kuhn's argument about commensurability. Theoretically, it is impossible to get out of one scientific paradigm into another, but we do. And indeed, two cultures are never entirely commensurable, but one can nevertheless mince them together. They are, if not co-measurable, at least what I would call co-mensable, co-thinkable. And then we can move on to the criterion that keeps caste together and apart in India, the criterion of commensality, eating together. We can, I hope, dine with other cultures, if not measure them as we measure our own. Commensality is also very much what a pluralist education is about, sitting down together at the same table. The metaphor of barking dogs has been used by historians of religions to describe the uses of comparison, and like all good myths, it bears retelling in each new context. Anything about a dog is always worth saying, and can always be used in new ways. Sherlock Holmes once solved a mystery, the case of Silver Blaze, a racehorse, by using a vital clue of omission. When Inspector Gregory asked Holmes whether he had noted any point to which he would draw the inspector's attention, Holmes replied, "To the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime." "The dog did nothing in the nighttime," objected the puzzled inspector, the essential straight man for the Socratic sage. "That was the curious incident," remarked Sherlock Holmes. The fact that the dog did not bark when someone entered the house at night was evidence, in this case, evidence that the criminal was someone familiar to the dog. Dogs bark at difference. In this case, someone different from those with whom the dog is familiar. We cannot, to borrow the Zen koan, hear the sound of one hand clapping. We cannot hear sameness. But through the comparative method, we can see the blinkers that each culture constructs for itself. Comparison makes it possible for us literally to cross-examine cultures by using a myth from one culture to reveal to us what is not in a telling from another culture, to find out the things not dreamt of in your philosophy, as Hamlet said to Horatio. Moreover, we can use comparative work to test theories about our own culture by noting where our own dogs have not barked. Comparison defamiliarizes what we take for granted. We can only see the inflection of a particular telling when we see other variants. The behavior of dogs offers another paradigm for the comparatist. Both the nature and the training of foxhounds makes them use their noses and not their eyes, as sighthounds like borzois do, to track the fox. A fox hunting colleague of mine, David Green, once described his frustration on seeing a fox just yards away from young hounds who had their nose to the ground and insisted on following the scent off into the distance where the fox had been and back again to where he was now, but would not be for long. An older hound would have had the sense to look up. Scholars bogged down in their rigid ways of scenting their prey are often forced by the comparative evidence to look up and see what is right in front of them, the more obvious and invisible human truths. I hope I have by now persuaded you that other people's myths are, to borrow Claude Lévi-Strauss's familiar phrase, good to think with. Let me take as an example of the benefits of thinking with other people's myths my own relationship with the theory of karma, which changed in major ways over the half century since I first encountered India. In a book I wrote in 1975 called The Origins of Evil in Hindu Mythology, I argued that the theory of karma was not regarded as an adequate explanation of evil even in its own country, as evidenced by the fact that the Hindus developed many other approaches to evil, including the myths that I wrote about in that book. In the preface to the second edition of that book, I remarked that I had changed my evaluation of the karma theory, had come to respect it more, in part by editing a 350-page book about it, Karma and Rebirth in Classical Indian Traditions, in 1980. Indeed, I gradually came first to think with and then to feel with the karma theory. The karma theory tells us that we have lived other lives, that our souls have had other bodies. But how can we feel, as well as accept intellectually, the reality of those other lives if we cannot remember them? Plato constructed his own version of this theory in the Myth of Ur in Book 10 of the Republic, but Plato was not a Neoplatonist, and neither Platonism nor Neoplatonism became an integral part of Western thinking about death. It is easier for Hindus, I think, to feel the theory of rebirth as they feel themselves to be a part of a larger human group in a way that we do not. They believe that they are joined in nature as well as in culture, both with the other people with whom they have present contact and with the people in the past and future to whom they are related. But what about us who are not Hindus? For us, the previous incarnation unrecalled has no existence. Reincarnation is generally regarded as a fresh start, but the tabula is not always quite so rasa as it is cracked up to be. Indian philosophy generally locates memory, which does not transmigrate, in what they call the manas in Sanskrit, a combination of mind and heart. Like the heart, it is a physical organ in the body, and like the mind, it is where you learn calculus, and like both mind and heart, it is where you fall in love, thus doubly blurring the Cartesian distinction between mind and body. But some branches of Indian philosophy locate memory in the soul, without, however, totally divorcing it from the body. For although the transmigrating soul, like the soul in Plato's Myth of Ur, usually loses its memory as it crosses the boundary of rebirth and sheds its body, some particularly gifted and or lucky people can remember their previous births. Even in Plato's myth, our transmigrating souls retain some sort of magnetic attachment to our old bodies and with them to our old personalities, like Eeyore to his detached tail. For before our minds are washed clean as we drink the waters of Lethe, we are given the choice of who to become in our next life. But we choose to become the same sort of person we were before, or, as the case may be, the very opposite of the sort of person we were before. One way or another, the force of our previous personality constrains and skews our rational choice. This is what Plato says. The choice was both laughable and amazing, since most people chose according to the habits of their former life. The soul that had been Orpheus chose to be a swan because he so hated the race of women, at whose hands he had met his death, that he did not want to be conceived and born of them. And Ur saw a swan changing into the life he chose as a man. When all the souls had chosen their lots, they went to the plain of oblivion and drank from the river of forgetfulness, and then they all fell asleep. Plato describes many other similar cases, each choice based on the experience of a previous life. Atalanta, seeing the great fame of an athlete, was unable to resist the temptation. The jester Thersites chose the form of a monkey, and so forth. The past exerts its force whether we run toward it or away from it. Even if we cannot remember who we are reborn in the shadow of that previous personality. The soul gets typecast. This belief is also expressed in Hindu texts, which imagine the reincarnating soul meditating on its next life, not on the far shore of Lethe, but in the womb of the soul's future mother, where it, not yet he or she, not only remains fully conscious, but remembers its previous lives in agonizing detail. This is from a Puranic medieval Sanskrit text. Then it begins to remember its many previous existences in the wheel of rebirth, and that depresses it, and it tosses from side to side thinking, I won't ever do that again. As soon as I get out of this womb, I'll do everything I can so I won't become an embryo again. It thinks it's also very bad to be an embryo in Hinduism because you're squished, which is a very bad thing. You've got your thumb beside your nose, they tell you in great detail, and you're in all this disgusting stuff, which is also anathema for Hindu feelings about body substances, the pus and the blood and all the food comes down. It's one of those stomach womb theories and so forth. So it's not a happy time for the embryo. And then it thinks, It thinks in this way as it remembers the hundreds of miseries of birth that it experienced before and the power of fate. Then as time goes by, the embryo turns around, head down, and in the 9th or 10th month it is born. As it comes out, it is hurt by the wind of procreation. It comes out crying because it is pained by the misery in its heart. When it has come out of the womb, it falls into an unbearable swoon, but it regains consciousness when it is touched by the air. Then Vishnu's deluding power of illusion assails him, and when his soul has been deluded by it, he loses his knowledge. As soon as the living creature has lost his knowledge, he becomes a baby. After that, he becomes a young boy, then an adolescent, and then an old man. And then he dies, and then he is born again as a human. Thus, he wanders on the wheel of rebirth like the bucket on the wheel of a well. So in this text, chagrin at the memory of previous mistakes and despair at the realization that one will make them all again in this life too is what makes the baby cry as it enters the world. Mae West once said that if she had her life to live over again, she would make all the same mistakes, but she would make them sooner. The laws of Manu, the code of Hindu social law composed early in the Common Era, promise many upwardly mobile transmigrations, but not for everyone. Most of us make the same mistakes sooner or later. The text says, through the repetition of their evil actions, men of little intelligence experience miseries in womb after womb. The body remembers some things, and the mind remembers others. But memory is not all there is. There is also a reality of unrecalled experience that gives a kind of validity to our connection with lives that we do not recall. The karma theory recognizes the parallelism between events forgotten within a single life, the events of early childhood, or the things that we repress, or that in Indian mythology we forget as the result of a curse, and the events forgotten from a previous life. It also recognizes a similarity in the ways in which we sometimes half recall these various sorts of events, often with a sense of déjà vu. We remember something that we cannot remember from a lost past through the power of the invisible tracks or traces left behind by our souls on these events. A similar concept of physical traces on the transmigrating soul may be seen in Plato's Gorgias, where a man who has been whipped bears the marks of the whip upon him when he is judged after his death. These traces the Hindus call perfumes. The word is vasanas in Sanskrit. Sense that are the impression of anything remaining unconsciously in the mind, the present consciousness of past perceptions, a force that accounts for a sense of déjà vu, among other things. These are the impressions of lingering emotions that a certain king, a famous king in Sanskrit literature, who has been cursed to forget the woman he loves, has in mind when he says, "Even a happy man may be overcome by passionate longing when he sees beautiful things or hears sweet sounds. Perhaps he is remembering something he was not conscious of before that moment, the loves of a former life firmly rooted in the impressions of lingering emotions." In the Hindu view, these are the karmic memory traces, the bits of experience that cling to our transmigrating souls, even in new bodies, loose threads trailing not merely from a former life within this lifespan, but from a previous incarnation. One commentator remarks that it is impossible to shake off these impressions even after thousands of lives. These unconscious memories of past lives predispose the transmigrating soul to act in one way or another in this life, in its new life. In many ways, the vasanas that return to the reborn soul correspond in part to the unconscious as we have come to understand it, more particularly to the repressed unconscious that returns in Freud's formulation. The signals that we send to ourselves from our former lives are wake-up calls, like the message that a character I love from Dr. Seuss's sleep book, he's called the Chippendale Mup. He's a creature that has a very, very long tail with a tuft on the end of it. At bedtime, he bites the end tuft on his very long tail so that the pain will work its way up the whole tail and finally wake him in the morning. Such perfumes or vasanas also correspond in many ways to the social chemical signals, chemo signals as she calls them, that Martha McClintock has studied. Olfactory clues to social behavior that are handed down genetically, which is in a sense through rebirths, generally unconscious clues that influence our emotions. Appropriately, McClintock named one group of these chemo signals closely related to what she has called pheromones after the vasanas of Hindu philosophy. After a brief consultation with me, this is what she wrote. Social chemo signals are remarkably similar to the medieval Sanskrit term vasanas. Vasana, the singular noun, is derived from the Sanskrit term vas, meaning to perfume. The term is used to explain why a person has a tendency to react to a situation in a particular way. We find it useful to adopt this philosophical term in our classification of human social chemo signals because both its etymology and its functional definition are so close to the findings from our empirical psychological data. Vasanas are those unconscious chemo signals whose functional effects are related to or predicted by their odor qualities when they are experienced consciously. The power of subconscious odors to evoke emotional memory-derived experience in humans is widely recognized, the Madeleines of Cambrai. Because they are not, that's me, then this is her. Because they are not necessarily conscious, the term vasana may be more appropriate than unconscious odors, which is an oxymoron. That was her, end of her. So I find these parallels convincing and meaningful. Social chemo signals aside, belief in reincarnation has long appealed to non-Hindu consciousness. The philosopher Frederick Myers, in his magnum opus, Human Personality and Its Survival of Bodily Death, published in 1903, thought up the notion of subliminal consciousness, a model in which the mind is never entirely present to itself, but constantly impelled by inaccessible memory layers. This was a material conception, not an idea of a soul. Karmic thinking continues to surface among us in New Age circles, in Hollywood, both in films and in the personal beliefs of stars like Shirley MacLaine, and in what might be called American folk belief. An advertisement for a book entitled Understanding Homosexuality Through Reincarnation by Numa J. Pillion claimed, "A gay man reveals the past lives of himself and other gays through life readings to understand homosexuality," end quote. Most scholars of Hinduism and Buddhism tread lightly upon the karma theory for reasons of intercultural tact or raging relativism, depending on your point of view. Some, including myself, go farther and grant the theory some degree of useful wisdom, at the very least as a powerful metaphor. But a more critical stance is taken by scholars such as Robert P. Goldman, who accused me in print of being coy. Coy. I've been called many things. Coy? Of being coy in my appreciation of karma and who questions my scientific stance and scholarly distance, I am quoting. You should know that Bob Goldman is my cousin by marriage, just by marriage. His father's sister was my father's brother's wife. So there's no blood between us, but we did know each other as children. I find myself therefore fighting a war on two fronts, against the Hindu who is actually Rajiv Malhotra, who accuses me of being insufficiently sympathetic to the Hindu view, and against Goldman on the other side, who accuses me of being too sympathetic to the Hindu view. I take heart here from the memory of something said to me by my old friend Ernest Gellner, now of blessed memory, who told me that the greatest compliment he'd ever been paid was a statement made by an angry colleague, "Comes the revolution, both sides will shoot you." For his part, Goldman has characterized the karma theory as nonsense. He asks, what is going on here? What could possibly induce intelligent and well-educated people to take this nonsense seriously? Then he exhorts us to ask down-to-earth questions about it. He writes, how do events in our real as opposed to imaginary pasts affect our later lives? What is our responsibility for events to which we were unwilling or even unwitting parties? What are the constraints upon our ability to recover clear memories of our early years? Central to these concerns are the issues of memory, its distortion, loss and recovery, and guilt, its assignment and displacement. And his answer to his good questions begins with a perceptive discussion of the connection between repressed childhood memories and the alleged memories of former lives. He writes, "The feelings and the terrible anxieties they generate are nonetheless real. What better way to partially confess to the former while at the same time fractionally discharging the latter," doesn't write well, "than to ascribe the aggression to someone who both is and is not oneself? If these dark feelings are the result of real events in one's past life, then by all means let us push the boundaries of our past back beyond childhood into the shadowy realm of past lives." So his phrase, "someone who both is and is not oneself," I think is a good statement of the ambivalence of the many people who do believe in the karma theory. Another tenet of the karma theory also explains a kind of psychological projection. That is, karma can be transferred from one person to another, particularly by exchanges of food and sex, but by any interhuman interaction. Goldman finds it preposterous to assert, as the theory does, that, quote, "we live in a strange and morally blind universe in which our own actions may see their rewards in the lives of other people, while we must content ourselves with the fruits of the actions of still others," end quote. Yet I think it needs no South Asian come from the grave to point out the relevance of this truth to our own lives, from the most tragic level to the most trivial. Caught up in the great Rube Goldberg machine of human causation, we enjoy the shade of trees planted by other people generations ago, and we miss our plane because some idiot rear-ends another idiot on the freeway. The tales of amnesia, like all myths, exaggerate and dramatize a situation that is entirely banal. So does the karma theory, which expresses the intuition that the things that happen to us now and that make us who we are consist in large part of forces from the past over which we have no control and little or no knowledge. After all, we all forget many of our former selves, the infant altogether, much of the child, some of the adolescent, or the former marriage, the pain of childbirth, and so forth. One door opens and another shuts. We awaken from one dream, not to full wakefulness, but to fall into another. The Hindu mythology of reincarnation analogizes the forgotten past life not to the lost or suppressed memories of childhood, but to our lost memories of our dreams. The karma theory, however, goes on to add the less obvious assertion that the other people who take the guilt or credit for our deeds, or for whose deeds we take the guilt or credit, are forms of ourselves. These are people who we must take it on faith or somehow identical with us. We cannot even expect to know exactly what it is we have done. It seems to me that the prime candidates for this role is our parents. The theory asserts both an identification and our ignorance of that identification. The identification sits well in a traditional society like Hinduism, which regards a son as his father reborn, but it goes against the grain of American individualism. Even an American, however, will acknowledge that a parent's crime may ruin the life of his or her child precisely because they are, in some significant sense, the same person. The ignorance of the identification also sticks in the American craw, and yet even within one life, never mind the karma theory, we are more often than not ignorant of the precise deeds committed by the people, usually our parents, who have made us what we are, people who are part of the very substance of our minds, and in the case of parents, our bodies. We are ignorant of them either because we have forgotten or repressed them, or because they took place before we were born. Hindu thinking does not regard the parents as the only or even the primary sources of karma. The transmigrating soul is said to mix its inherited karma with the karma of each of the new parents to form the cumulative karma of the new child. It's a logical circle. Your karma gives you certain sorts of parents, and then you get the karma of that sort of parents. It does work out if you try. But parents are, I think, the best way to translate the Hindu theory of karma into something that makes sense for people who do not believe in the rebirth of the soul after death. Parents, or more generally genetic inheritance, are what led Martha McClintock to apply the term vasanas to the social chemo signals that are handed down in the DNA, the equivalent of vasanas referring to the effect of a previous life on one's current life. From unknown episodes in the lives of our parents and grandparents and more distant ancestors, we get not only the shape of our noses, but our susceptibility to certain diseases and perhaps to certain sorts of people. There is a long continuum of parental influence. Closest are the things we remember that our parents did for us or to us relatively recently, then the things that they did when we were so little that we cannot remember them clearly or at all, then the things like smoking or contracting AIDS that our mothers did to us while we were in the womb, then the things that our parents did before we were born, and finally, both the genetic stock and the cultural memories transmitted from earlier generations, the things that happened during the pogroms in Russia, the traumas suffered during the Depression. The weight of these influences, the realization that we are not and never were a tabula rasa on which we can inscribe ourselves as we would wish to be, is one of the insights that drive the karma theory. Parents are the key to Goldman's understanding of the karma theory, too. He argues that Freud's idea of the Oedipus complex best explains the karma theory as a reaction against parental abuse. All South Asians, he says, were abused by their parents and bamboozled by Brahmins, who profited from the naivete of people overwhelmed by guilt and anxiety as a result of believing the karma theory. He goes on to argue, and here I quote, "What could that complex of emotions plausibly be other than the desire, in fact, to kill one's father, and the powerful mixture of guilt and devastating anxiety that that desire must generate, especially in a social milieu in which the father and his surrogates are both abusive and menacing to their sons? It is a natural response to emotional and physical abuse suffered at the hands of adults. Such anger in a culture like India's can only be turned inward. Such an emotional climate, widely pervasive in most cultures, but heavily institutionalized and thinly disguised in traditional India, easily gives rise to a situation where the victim of abuse encouraged to revere, even worship, where the victim of abuse is encouraged to revere, even to abuse, worship his, I can't even say it, where the victim of abuse is encouraged to revere, even worship his abuser," end quote. My emphasis on the role of parents in the karma theory differs from Goldman's in several ways, but most significantly in his assumption that the parental influence will be negative and produce anxiety and guilt. My assumption is that it may indeed be and do all of that. Philip Larkin said it best, "They fuck you up, your mom and dad. They do not mean to, but they do." But I also believe that it counts for the transmission of talents, positive memories, such as those stirred by music and art, and above all, irrational love, or the ability to fall in love at first sight, generally with a highly inappropriate person who either is or most definitely is not just like our father or mother. For those of us who lack the imagination to perceive the infinity of our lives in time, it might be possible to perceive the infinity of our lives in human space. Again, the Indian texts tell us that we are karmically linked to all the other people in the world. They are us. I have known and respected this theory for a long time, though I have not always believed it. But for one important moment, I did believe it, and I wrote about it in my book, Other People's Myths, in 1988. It was at a time when I was feeling rather sorry for myself for having only one child. I wished that I had lots of children, and now it was too late. I felt that having six children would have meant having an entirely different life, which is certainly true, not merely six times the life of a woman with one child, and I wanted that life as well as the life that I had. This thought was in my mind as I wandered on a beach in Ireland and saw a woman with lots and lots of children, very nice children too, and at their best, as young children often are on a beach. Normally, I would have envied her, but this time I enjoyed her children. I was happy to watch them. And suddenly I felt that they were mine, that the woman on the beach had had them for me so that they would be there for me to watch them as they played in the water. Her life was my life too. I felt it then and I remember it now. What had been an idea to me until then, the idea of my karmic identity with other people, became an experience. I was able to live her life in my imagination. One way of interpreting my epiphany of the woman on the beach was this realization that my connection to her, and through her to every other woman who ever had or ever would have children, meant that my brief lifespan was expanded into the lifespans of all the other people in the world. This is a very Hindu way of looking at one's relationships with other people. Woven through the series of individual lives, each consisting of a cluster of experiences, was the thread of the experience itself, in this case, motherhood. That experience would survive when her children and mine were long dead. I felt then that all the things that one wanted to do and to be existed in eternity. They stood there forever as long as there was human life on the planet Earth. They were like beautiful rooms that anyone could walk into. And when I could no longer walk into them, they would still be there. They were part of time. And though they could not go on being part of me for much longer, part of me would always be there in them. Something of me would linger still in those things that I had loved, like the perfume or pipe smoke that tells you that someone has been in a room before you. This is the same perfume, the same karmic trace of memory that adheres to the transmigrating soul. And through my connection with the woman on the beach, I would be the people in the future who sensed in that room the perfume that I had left behind. Though, unless I was a gifted sage, I would not recognize it as my perfume. And perhaps, since I am not a Hindu, that is as close as I can come to believing that I can remember my other lives, remembering other people's lives as my life. And perhaps it is close enough. Let me turn now from karma to kama. People often mix them up and call it the Karma Sutra, which always makes me mad. And let us consider the ways in which we can and cannot think or feel with the Kama Sutra. Working, as I've been for some years, on a new translation of the Kama Sutra, which came out this spring, I became aware time and time again of the way that the foreignness of the cultural assumptions of the text simultaneously enlarged my own vision of what was possible, illuminated the invisible arbitrary walls that my own culture had used to veto certain possibilities even before they could be considered and rejected, and in turn revealed a common denominator in human culture. Some of the Kama Sutra, like, for instance, the magic formulas, I think remains entirely foreign to us. Here's a passage. If you make a powder by pulverizing leaves scattered by the wind, garlands left over from corpses, and peacock bones, it puts someone in your power. If you pulverize a female buzzard that died a natural death and mix the powder with honey and gooseberry, it puts someone in your power. Magic and drugs, betel, the life of the harem, the world of courtesans, these parts of the Kama Sutra text make you think how very different these people are from us. But then you come across this passage in a section about courtship and flirtation, advice for a young boy who wants to make a young girl notice him. Quote, when they're playing in the water, he dives underwater at some distance from her, comes up close to her, touches her, and dives underwater again right there. Here you are in familiar territory. For me, this passage immediately evoked the summers of my early teens spent in various camps in the Adirondacks, where the boys did precisely this whenever we swam in the lake and the buddy system and all of that. You must surely also recognize the man who tells the woman on whom he set his sights, quote, about an erotic dream, pretending that it was about another woman. Sometimes the unfamiliar and the familiar are cheek by jowl. The culture-specific list of women the wife must not associate with, including a Buddhist nun and a magician who uses love sorcery worked with roots, is followed in the very next passage by the woman who is cooking for her man and finds out, this is what he likes, this is what he hates, this is good for him, this is bad for him. A consideration that surely resonates with many contemporary Anglophone readers, cooking for someone they love, balancing the desire to please, perhaps with a béarnaise sauce, with the concern for the rising cholesterol level. This constant alternation of the familiar and the strange teaches us a great deal about human nature. I want to end with some remarks on the joys of comparison with which I began. Comparing our religion with someone else's religion forces us to come to terms with the other, the one both different from us and the same as us. The challenge lies in choosing, as the other with whom we assume an initial likeness, an other as possible, as different from us as possible, perhaps one whom we don't like or understand at all at first, and have to work hard to like or understand. The comparison that chooses an other in which the initial likeness is more immediately apparent is more ethnocentric, it's easier, and ultimately it proves less. But what aspects of the other define the otherness? My colleague David Tracy, the Catholic theologian, is fond of engaging in dialogues with Buddhists. I used to chide him that he was taking the easy way out by choosing the reasonable, ethical Buddhists. To dialogue with Hindus would be the real test, all those gods, all those arms and heads. Not at all, he replied. Buddhists are far more other than Hindus for a Catholic theologian, since they have no god at all, rather than too many gods, which is the Hindu challenge, mediated by the multiplicity of Catholic saints, the Trinity, and so forth. Indeed, Catholicism and Hinduism have much in common, so much that a structuralist might suggest that Catholicism is to Protestantism, as Hinduism is to Buddhism, as South is to North, as multiplicity is to unity, as hot is to cold, as kitsch is to aniconism, and so forth. But Judaism, although monotheistic and hence on that level at least less other than the atheism of Buddhism or the polytheism of Hinduism, turns out for historical reasons to pose even greater problems for a Catholic who wishes to engage in dialogue. Judaism has served as a projection for Catholics for so many years that the Jews are too close, too tangled with Catholic history to be seen by many Catholics as they really are. Unlike the Buddhists, the Jews must be retrieved from the Catholic projection and acknowledged in their reality, their real otherness, before the conversation can even begin. If we choose to use for the other in our comparison a less dichotomizing word than same, such as similar, we might construct a continuum or a Venn diagram of shared ideas overlapping circles, a set of categories that interlock like chain mail with various degrees of resemblances or family likenesses, to use Wittgenstein's term. As the themes and overlap, it becomes apparent that there is no actual center to the group, no single indispensable or defining theme, merely a shifting cluster. This emptiness in the center suggests that the figure might better be named, rather than a Venn diagram, I call it a Zen diagram, because there's emptiness in the middle. In this way, we can replace polarized grids, North and South, Catholic and Buddhist, with infinitely fluid continuums. But whatever word we choose to use for the same, like, similar, resembling pole of the comparison, we must come to terms with the other pole, the pole of difference. And no matter what sort of an other we choose at the start, from the initial assumption of likeness or sameness or similarity, we must go on to end up with difference. Moreover, similarity must not be allowed to be normative. To assume one's original stance, to begin by assuming the self in the other on some level, to say that the other is like me, is to some extent inevitable. But it must be immediately qualified by both difference and the shift of center. One must go on to say, I am like you. I will be able to understand you because I am like you. And then later, I see ways in which you are, in fact, not like me. One must end by going over to the other side. For instance, if you know the Greek epic, the Iliad, you begin reading the Sanskrit epic, the Ramayana, by saying, it's like the Iliad, an epic. In fact, even the application of the word epic to the Sanskrit text is an old European move, which is actually questionable. But then you must shift the ground to notice how the Iliad is not like the Ramayana. It is natural but not good to be ethnocentric. Acknowledging it is the first step, but cannot be an excuse, a justification. You have to go on to see how the rest of the world is. There is no value-free comparison, but you do the best you can. The initial assumed comparison is always between us and the other. This happens whenever we confront a single phenomenon from a culture not our own. Indeed, one of the arguments in favor of the comparative method is that even methods that pretend to be culturally specific are in fact comparative when you take into account the fact that the scholar studying the one other culture will always be making implicit judgments based upon an implicit comparison between the other culture and the scholar's own culture. Moreover, particular tellings need the comparative insight to prevent the interpreter from glossing that telling only in terms of the specific cultural context. A Cinderella tale in India, for instance, may very well be told in terms of the caste system, Cinderella treated as an untouchable. But it cannot be explained only in terms of the caste system once one knows that that story also occurs in other cultures that have no caste system. The key to the game of cross-cultural comparison lies in selecting the sorts of questions that might transcend any particular culture. Some people think that there are no such questions, but some think, as I do, that worthwhile cross-cultural questions can be asked. Claude Lévi-Strauss said it best and most boldly when he wrote, "In proposing the study of mankind, anthropology frees me from doubt, since it examines those differences and changes in mankind which have a meaning for all men and excludes those peculiar to a single civilization which dissolves into nothingness under the gaze of the outside observer." End quote. Thus, difference itself becomes a basis for a comparison made possible only by the assumption that difference has a meaning for all men, and presumably for all women, I would have added. In other words, one of the ways in which we are all alike is in our shared interest in our differences. This seems to me to be a very good place at which to start the work of comparison, and an equally good place at which to end this argument for it. Thank you.
Professor Wendy Doniger of the University of Chicago, speaking on Other People's Myths. Her lecture is one in a series under the auspices of the Institute for Religion and Philosophy series on religion and world affairs. This year, entitled The Stranger's Religion, Fascination and Fear. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Andy Farnsworth, with help from Tim Skog and Ian Lowe. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is W.